From Pacifica Station KPFK in Los Angeles, this is Free Speech Radio News. It's Monday, the 2nd of March, 2009. World leaders pledged some $3 billion to rebuild Gaza. We'll hear from the donor conference in Egypt about what strings are attached to those funds. Kansas Governor Kathleen Sebelius is tapped for a health secretary charged with leading aggressive health care reform. And we'll go to Phoenix, where thousands of protesters took a stand against the man that calls himself America's toughest sheriff. Those stories after this news.
I'm Nell Abram with the headlines for Free Speech Radio News. Tens of thousands of people attended a mass funeral service in Bangladesh today for 50 of the victims of last week's two-day mutiny by some 9,000 Border Guard troops. A high-level member of the Guards, known as the Bangladesh Rifles, is believed to have led the revolt and was arrested today. Officials say they are seeking and hope to charge some 1,000 others. As girls in Pakistan's Swat Valley prepare to go back to school, a suicide bomber attacked a school in the southern province of Baluchistan. Mazur Hussein reports.
Six people were killed today in a suicide attack on a madrasa in the Baluchistan province, which is a border with both Afghanistan and Iran. Some view this as an expansion of the Taliban's activities into more provinces in Pakistan. The chief minister of Pakhtunkhwa province visited the war-ravaged Swat Valley today, where he declared that girls wearing the Islamic headscarf would not be able to go to school. But teachers say parents are still afraid to send the girls out, and there are not many school buildings left. The Taliban destroyed over 100 schools in the past year to stop the Pakistan army from using them as bases. As a truce between the Swat Taliban and the Pakistani government seems to hold, the United States launched another drone attack in the tribal areas, killing 12 people. Locals say the Taliban took away the dead bodies for burial. For Free Speech Radio News, I'm Masroor Hussain in Islamabad.
The CIA has admitted destroying nearly 100 videotapes documenting interrogations. The acknowledgement came in a letter submitted to a federal court today. The court is considering a lawsuit brought by the ACLU seeking records of the treatment of prisoners held abroad in U.S. custody. According to the ACLU, the video showed suspects being harshly treated during interrogations. The tapes were also withheld from the 9/11 Commission. Voters in a small Maine town approved an ordinance that empowers people living in the community to control their natural resources and takes away the rights of an individual from a corporate entity. Meredith DeFrancesco explains.
The issues of democratic power and local citizen input concerning the parceling out of natural resources to corporate enterprise are central to the issue of water extraction in Maine. Nestle, the world's largest food and beverage company, now owns the bottled water label Poland Springs in Maine and is currently tapping 8 wells in the state with hopes to expand. Town residents who object to the sale of their water find themselves with few legal options. The discovery that Nestle had been drilling test sites in the local wildlife preserve led to townspeople proposing a rights-based ordinance requiring town leaders to put the decision to the voting community. The ordinance also gives rights to ecosystems and denies corporations the rights of personhood. Despite opposition from the selectmen, the ordinance passed this Saturday. The neighboring town of Newfield is set to follow suit on March 14th. For FSRN, this is Meredith DeFrancesco at WERU Community Radio in Blue Hill, Maine.
The U.S. Supreme Court met today to hear arguments regarding the rights, or lack thereof, to DNA testing of evidence. The case involves an Alaska man convicted of kidnapping and sexual assault. All but 6 states provide convicts access to DNA testing. Alaska is one of the few that does not. Also at the court today, justices declined to consider whether American and Vietnamese victims of Agent Orange can sue companies that made the toxic chemical defoliant used in the Vietnam War. More than 3,000 Mexican soldiers have arrived in Ciudad Juarez to concentrate more military muscle and resources behind a 2-year-old offensive against drug cartels. Shannon Young has more.
The deployment is part of a major operation to use federal forces to stamp out the drug cartels operating in the state of Chihuahua. Another 1,800 soldiers are due to arrive in Ciudad Juarez in the coming days. Nearly 6,000 people died in Mexico last year in drug-related violence. More than a quarter of those deaths took place in Ciudad Juárez, Mexico's largest border city. This year's murder rate isn't looking much better, with the death toll for the Ciudad Juárez area alone already reaching close to 400. In his appearance on Meet the Press yesterday, U.S. Defense Secretary Robert Gates said drug violence along the border has become a serious security problem and that the U.S. military could support Mexico with resources, training, surveillance capabilities, and intelligence. For FSRN, I'm Shannon Young.
The streets of Guinea-Bissau are largely deserted today after President João Bernardo Vieira was assassinated last night. The attack came just hours after the army chief was also murdered. The nation's two privately held radio stations were silenced today, while state-run radio said there was no coup in the works. Reports suggest that only military vehicles are traveling the capital streets today. Guinea-Bissau's coast has become a port of call for Colombian drug cartels in recent years. For Free Speech Radio News from WMNF Community Radio in Tampa, I'm Nell Abram.
International leaders gathered in Egypt's resort town of Sharm el-Sheikh in a conference aimed at raising money to rebuild the Gaza Strip after it was devastated as a result of Israel's recent 23-day-long attack. Nearly $3 billion were pledged in the day-long conference, almost one-third of that money from the United States. But not all the money pledged today will be going to rebuild Gaza. As FSRN's Aya Batraoui reports, there are strict political conditions on how the money will be spent.
Palestinian President Mahmoud Abbas was aiming for $2.8 billion in pledges from international donors. Instead, he received more. He received $3 billion in aid from 70 world leaders gathered Monday in the Egyptian town of Sharm el-Sheikh. Speaking at the conference, U.S. Secretary of State Hillary Clinton said that the United States would assist with $900 million, but only about a third of that will go to rebuild the Gaza Strip. The United States put forth strict conditions that the rest of the money be used to assist the U.S.-friendly Fatah-led Palestinian Authority headed by Abbas, whose term in presidency expired in January.
We have worked with the Palestinian Authority to install safeguards that will ensure that our funding is only used where and for whom it is intended and does not end up in the wrong hands.
For his part, Abbas said that Gaza needs more than just money. A political settlement is also needed, he said. Arab Gulf states contributed around $1.6 billion at the conference, and European countries pledged nearly $500 million in aid for Palestinians. But if the various Palestinian factions, specifically Hamas and its rival Fatah, cannot form a unity government by the end of the month, countries will have to decide how to disperse the funds so that it does not violate international laws by going directly to Hamas. Some argue, though, that the money is simply a political weapon meant to pressure Palestinians. Hamas, which was not invited to attend the conference, called on the international community to recognize its legitimacy as the elected government of the Gaza Strip on the same day that leaders were meeting in Sharm el-Sheikh. Egyptian President Hosni Mubarak, who hosted the conference and is mediating between Palestinian factions and Israel, said Israel should not tie up peace talks by demanding the release of Israeli soldier Gilad Shalit before agreeing to a long-term ceasefire. He also blamed Israel for pulling out of mediated Egyptian talks by calling a unilateral ceasefire to halt the bombardment of Gaza.
In spite of Israel's unfortunate pullout after it had agreed through frequent rounds of talks via Egypt between the two sides, and in spite of Israel's insistence to refuse a ceasefire by holding on to a prisoner exchange, Egypt has continued talks with Israel to change its position in order to reach a ceasefire as soon as possible.
Mubarak has also called on Israel to open its crossings with the Gaza Strip for more aid to get in. Since the war ended, Israel has only allowed a trickle of aid to enter Gaza, but neither equipment nor materials to rebuild have been permitted into Gaza by Israel. Reporting for FSRN from Egypt, this is Aya Batraoui.
Meanwhile, thousands of Gazans are waiting for the reconstruction process to begin. More than 30,000 Palestinian homes were devastated during Israel's attack, and people in Gaza are eager to have their homes rebuilt. FSRN's Rami Almagari has more.
In the northern Gaza town of Jabalia, A newly married young couple had no choice but to celebrate the recent wedding party in a newly erected refugee camp after their homes were destroyed during the last Israeli war. Ahmed El-Hirsh is a 22-year-old bridegroom. He spoke to Afa Saran from inside his tent in the Al Rayyan refugee camp in northern Gaza.
I would like to send a message to the Arab and Islamic nations to remember us, to lift the siege imposed on us and help us.
Ahmed and thousands of others in Gaza who are waiting to have their destroyed homes rebuilt are relying on the international players who met Monday in Egypt to discuss how to rebuild the war-hit territory. But some say the most important aspect of rebuilding Gaza is not being addressed. Sami Mushasha is a spokesperson for UNRWA.
The key point in all this process is that all this money and all this goodwill means nothing if the borders are remain closed or if the Israeli authorities keep denying UNRWA and other UN agencies the right to enter Gaza, the right to bring all needed items.
Even though Hamas was not invited to participate, it welcomed the Egyptian-hosted donors' meeting. However, a spokesperson warned that the donors' conference also was political and that some international players want to force Hamas to meet three demands: recognizing Israel, renouncing the right to self-defense, and accepting past signed agreements with Israel. United States, Western governments, and Israel have boycotted Hamas after the party won the 2006 parliamentary elections. In June 2007, Israel enforced a crippling blockade on the Hamas-ruled Gaza Strip, while Palestinian President Mahmoud Abbas of Fatah outlawed Hamas. For Free Speech Radio News, I am Rami Al-Mighari in Gaza.
Some 12,000 mostly college student activists arrived in Washington last week to take part in the Power Shift Conference, which seeks to unify various efforts pushing for an energy policy that more directly addresses the issues of global warming. The conference culminated today in a historic number of lobby visits, yet many felt that diplomatic action alone will not lead to substantial change. As FSRN's Sam Greenspan reports, many activists have taken to measures of civil disobedience at the Capitol.
This morning marked one of the largest coordinated lobbying efforts for clean energy in U.S. history. Thousands of activists from all 50 states and 15 other countries scheduled nearly 400 lobby visits with lawmakers. But Joshua Khan Russell of the Rainforest Action Network isn't convinced that only talking with lawmakers will lead to the changes necessary to avert a global climate crisis.
And, you know, if we have to jump across a big cliff, if we just go three-fourths of the way, that's not going to cut it. We're still going to fall.
Russell is one of the key organizers for the Capitol Climate Action, which organized a march today to the U.S. Capitol Power Plant.
You know, we do think that actions like this change the game in terms of what's politically realistic, and we think a lot more is politically realistic than is currently being talked about. We know that there's going to be climate legislation passed within the next year, but what we need is to make sure that it is as bold and strong as it needs to be and consistent with the science, and that right now really is our moment to do that and push it.
Russell and other demonstrators marched to the plant from Capitol Hill, encircling it with an estimated 3,000 others. Even though House Speaker Nancy Pelosi and Senate Majority Leader Harry Reid have already issued a statement of their intent to locate funds to retrofit the Capitol power plant to a 100% natural gas facility, Russell still sees today's action as vital.
This is, you know, the first part of a major victory for us. We see this as icing on the cake, that of course our message is bigger than this particular plant, but it really demonstrates that, since 2007, they've been trying to convert this plant over, but it wasn't until There's major mass grassroots mobilization that they were able to do it. And so this is a politically savvy movement that's applying outside pressure to give political leverage on the inside. And it really shows that a lot of these changes can be made just from political will alone, and we're helping create that.
Marching with colorful banners with slogans like "Coal destroys communities," the demonstrators were met by a police blockade. Young people are not the only demonstrators, however. Judy Bonds is in D.C. from a coal mining town in West Virginia. Her grandson makes the 10th generation her family has been in the Marfork Holler, where her community now suffers from health problems related to the environmental side effects from coal extraction through mountaintop removal. Bonds participated in the lobbying visits earlier today, then joining the efforts in civil disobedience, hoping to tell the country what the coal industry has done to her community.
I live in a war zone. Everyone that lives in the Coal River Valley or that lives near mountaintop removal strip mining sites are getting bombed and blasted every day. You haven't lived until you try to sit on your toilet and then get blasted off your toilet. They're using 3.5 million pounds of explosives a day to blast the tops off the mountains to obtain coal that's being burned right here in D.C. That coal has my blood on it. It has my father's blood on it.
Bonds also says she wants to make it clear that so-called clean coal, which President Obama has included in part of his energy plan, is something of a pipe dream.
The problem is, even if you could get rose petals to come out of the smokestacks up here in D.C. or any place else, if you're blowing up mountains and poisoning people's air and water to extract that coal, you can't burn it clean if you can't dig it clean.
Some came to the demonstration today willing to be arrested for the sake of green energy. Among those is writer and college professor Bill McKibben.
All the things that are going on here are facets of a healthy movement, and I like all of it. I like lobbying elected officials, and I'm not sure I like getting arrested, but I'm willing to get arrested if that's what it takes.
McKibben has worked closely with students from Middlebury College on climate change issues and says that students' efforts in lobbying and direct action could signify a return to an age of student organizing not seen in decades.
I think there's no question that this is a new era of student power. Look, I don't think there's been a gathering of 12,000 college kids for a weekend all fixated on doing the same kind of political work for a very long time. I've spent 20 years waiting to see what the global warming movement would look like, and it looks great.
Demonstrators say they will continue to occupy the area around the plant into the evening. For Free Speech Radio News in Washington, this is Sam Greenspan.
Though not as high profile as the environmentalists that took over Washington today, activists from around the world also came together to protest military bases in foreign countries. They held a conference over the weekend, and Monday they took their message to Capitol Hill. Tanya Snyder reports.
The United States maintains an estimated 1,000 military bases in more than 90 countries around the world. Almost half of those are World War II holdovers in Germany, Italy, and Japan. The activists that gathered in Washington said that foreign military bases cost the U.S. $140 billion a year and do more harm than good. Ecuador's new constitution bans foreign military bases, and its government is working to close the U.S. airbase in Manta on the Pacific coast. Activist Gualdemar Jimenez says the impact on the indigenous community has been too great.
They're not allowed to fish in the area near the base anymore. It's banned for security reasons.
More than 200 people representing at least 12 countries attended the conference called Security Without Empire. One of them was Jana Glevitska from the Czech Republic. A U.S. radar station in her country has been in the works for the last 3 years, negotiated behind closed doors. Glevitska says it's part of the National Missile Defense System to protect the U.S. against the Soviet Union.
It's the system that doesn't work against the threat that doesn't exist in the country that doesn't want it.
Carmen Valencia is from Vieques, the Puerto Rican island that the U.S. Navy inhabited until 2003. She says her hometown's experience serves as a warning that the problems linger even after the military leaves.
The Marines have left Vieques. We threw them out. But there's still the cleanup, there's the return of the lands, and the development of the lands. And that's what we're fighting for now, for the cleanup to be thorough. For 60 years, they were just covering up toxic waste. And that's what we want to get rid of.
The organizers of the Security Without Empire conference are asking members of Congress to hold hearings to examine the issue. They know they won't score many quick victories, but they hope to start bringing the troops home, not just from Iraq, but from U.S. military bases around the world. For FSRN, I'm Tanya Snyder in Washington.
President Obama nominated Kansas Governor Kathleen Sebelius to head the Department of Health and Human Services. The nomination comes just in time for a White House-convened conference on health care reform. FSRN's Leanne Caldwell reports.
Kathleen Sebelius is a second-term Democratic governor in a Republican state with a background in health care, qualities President Obama says are necessary to lead reform.
What's wrong with our health care system is no longer just a moral imperative, but a fiscal imperative. Healthcare reform that reduces costs while expanding coverage is no longer just a dream we hope to achieve. It's a necessity we have to achieve.
Before governor, Sebelius was insurance commissioner, where she blocked a takeover of the nonprofit Blue Cross Blue Shield by a private insurance company. Ron Pollack is executive director of Families USA, a liberal health policy organization in Washington, D.C. He's impressed with Sebelius.
She regulated the insurance industry. She has shown that she is willing to take risks and to stand up to the insurance industry if that's what's needed to protect the interests of consumers and patients.
As governor, Sebelius focused on health care. She created a new state agency to develop and maintain policy recommendations to provide quality, affordable care for all Kansans. The Kansas Health Policy Authority held 22 town hall meetings across the state and recommended goals for 2009, that Kansas expand Medicaid to include parents at federal poverty level and increase health care access to young adults. Dr. Sharon Lee is a member of Physicians for a National Health Program, which supports single-payer health care. She also runs a family practice for the poor in Kansas City. She says Sebelius has been open and inclusive.
She is somebody who knows the area. She's quite knowledgeable. I'm not sure that she is as gung-ho about a single-payer system as I would like to see.
Sebelius herself promises an open discussion.
The work won't be easy, but bringing about real change rarely is. Business and labor leaders, teachers and healthcare providers, policymakers at the state, local, and national level, parents and children are ready to join this effort. This isn't a partisan challenge, it's an American challenge, and one that we can't afford to ignore.
Abortion opponents are concerned with her pro-choice policies. Also today, President Obama named Nancy Ann DeParl to be health care czar to lead the newly created White House Office of Health Reform. She's currently a commissioner for the Department of Human Services in Tennessee. President Obama is convening a health care reform forum at the White House Thursday to bring together interested parties. He's already laid aside $630 billion for reform in his proposed budget. For Free Speech Radio News, I'm Leanne Caldwell.
Activists from around the country descended on Phoenix, Arizona Saturday to demonstrate against Maricopa County Sheriff Joe Arpaio. They say his deputies are responsible for creating a human rights crisis in Arizona by dehumanizing immigrants and racially profiling Maricopa County residents. Evan Wylojay reports from Phoenix.
Roughly 3,000 demonstrators trickled into Indian Steel Park Saturday morning before filing into the streets of downtown Phoenix to show their opposition to Maricopa County Sheriff Joe Arpaio. For 8 years, the Maricopa County Sheriff's Office has targeted immigrants under a controversial arrangement with the Federal Immigration and Customs Enforcement Agency called the 287G contract, which allows Arpaio's office to enforce immigration laws. Salvador Reza heads an organization called Puente and helped organize the march.
We had a conference 2 weeks ago. Over 75 organizations participated nationwide, and they decided that they wanted to do an action on the 28th year. So I said, well, let's go for it, and we did that.
Reza thinks the problems with Arpaio's enforcement are clear.
Just a simple person that's driving to the supermarket and all of a sudden says they're separated from their kids, and then say that those are dangerous criminals, when in reality they're just workers trying to find work.
In response to repeated allegations that Arpaio's deputies racially profile, and to his recent public marching of inmates charged with immigration violations into segregated jail quarters, several federal lawmakers, including Congressmember John Conyers, have called on the Justice Department to investigate Arpaio for civil rights abuses and to determine whether he has violated the terms of his 287G contract. Arpaio has publicly invited Conyers and any others who doubt the lawfulness of his agency to come and observe his department. In addition to drawing attention to Arpaio's harsh tactics, some see the march as a way to raise awareness about immigration reform. FSRN interviewed this 34-year-old undocumented immigrant who brought his wife and three children out to the march Saturday, despite the fear he has of being arrested and perhaps deported.
It will be terrible for me if he kicks me out of the country, but my children will be the one who suffer the most, because they won't be able to survive on their own.
A construction worker by trade, he said he's been in the United States for 15 years. The Sinaloa, Mexico native finds it difficult to support his family during the current economic slump.
And you working?
No, ahorita no, muy poco.
I'm not working right now either, or very little anyway. We're barely making it right now, doing whatever we can to survive.
Paul Espinoza, a local filmmaker, came to the march to show his solidarity. He believes that Arpaio's use of the federal 287G contract has been stretched beyond its intention or reasonable application.
Basically, with 287G, a lot of agencies have a lot of discretion. And, you know, they have discretion, a wide range of things that they could do or could not do. And I think that what you see here under the sheriff's, you know, agency is basically taking it to a real extreme.
As the demonstrators marched by Sheriff Joe Arpaio's office, hundreds of Arpaio supporters waved banners and signs showing their disagreement with the marchers. Tensions rose to such a degree that a line of police officers had to keep the two sides away from one another. Sheriff Arpaio wasn't there, but responded later Saturday at a press conference.
This is a free country. Everybody has a right to demonstrate. I'm happy that there was no danger involved or violations of the law.
Once the demonstrators reached the downtown federal building, representatives from Somos Americanos, Coalition for Latino Political Action, La Raza, and even Zach De La Roca from Rage Against the Machine spoke out against Sheriff Arpaio and his tactics. The demonstrators called for federal revocation of the contract and expressed their hopes for an eased assimilation of immigrants into American culture. In downtown Phoenix, Evan Wyloge for Free Speech Radio News.
And that wraps it up for our newscast today. From Pacifica Station KPFK in Los Angeles, I'm Aura Bogado.